Good. I'm a listener, so I feel like we're all old friends.
Okay. Yeah, that's true. There is that psychosocial relationship with podcasters, but I mean, the issue with our podcast is like I'm worried about which ones you may have listened to. Not that like,
I do have. There was one I listened to. It was like a couple of weeks ago that I have major beef with.
Okay. Wait, should we be rolling?
I think we are rolling. Anyway, go on.
I think Raf, you was the one you guys talked about. You don't see movies. Is that?
Yes, this is accurate.
Because I got to tell you, that is 98% of my entire personality.
Oh, really?
Like, just seeing,
he likes movies.
Oh, I thought you were a fellow traveler.
I try and talk to my wife, and I can't articulate my feelings without referencing some obscure 80s movie. Yeah. So don't try any of that. On opposite sides of the
do family. Not try any of that stuff here. It's, yeah. They will not fly. Alrighty. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a wonderful guest on Downran for you today. We're joined by Kyle Harrison, who's general partner at Contrary, a US-based venture capital fund. Kyle and I used to work together, and he writes the newsletter Investing 101 2.0, which is great. Mm. I'm not just blowing smoke up your ass. It's a great newsletter. And one of the reasons I want to bring you on, because there's some red-hot insight in there. Kyle, welcome to Downran.
I appreciate it. I'm excited.
Now, Kyle, you mentioned that actually you've heard the podcast, so you would know, first question, like hot off the press, crypto is pumping again. What are some tokens that our listeners should be purchasing?
Oh, man. I'm not a crypto guy, which means that I've probably made a lot of money on crypto, because the dumber you are, the more money you make. I can't point to the coins. I may be a Bitcoin purist, maybe I'd say.
Oh, yeah, we got a maxi.
Okay, we got a maxi.
Just keep hawking.
Great.
Now, why not start there? Why no investment? Why not into crypto? So Contrary, the portfolio doesn't have a lot of crypto in it.
We don't have a lot of crypto. So like our firm is a little bit unique. It's very people-centric. Mm-hmm. And so we spent a lot of time and a lot of effort identifying super smart people, getting to know them, what they're working on. But occasionally that is not too dissimilar from having a uncle that you have to talk down from a rant at family dinners. Mm-hmm. Is that sometimes really smart people get excited about things that maybe they ought not to be excited about. And so we try and bring them back sometimes. There are certainly some interesting things in crypto, but the vast majority of things, I would subscribe to the belief that many things are solutions looking for problems and have not yet seen compelling problems to solve. But that doesn't mean that there are smarter people than me that understand it more deeply and are going to make a ton of money solving actual problems that do exist, but I've not heard them yet.
Reasonable response. So speaking of actual problems, I mean, getting straight into it, let's talk about big themes right now. Like, what are some kind of big problems that you kind of see that like you're basically looking to invest in that you see being solved and being sorted in the next kind of, you know, what's your time horizon? 10 years.
10 years, yeah. People typically think about it. I mean, obviously, the thing that everybody and their mother, including my dad, who today was texting me about AI, wants to talk about AI. So that is certainly like a very broad theme that we can unpack how we think about it and stuff. But that is touching everything.
Yeah, we were talking about this the other week that it's reached the parent level where it's like, hey, have you heard about this AI stuff? Which is a sign.
It's a sign of something, that's for sure. Reading into the tea leaves, I think, is an interesting exercise of what that actually means. But it has reached that level. My dad is texting me about stuff. So AI is touching everything. I think there was something really interesting. I saw a chart of so Y Combinator had their demo day where it's gotten something crazy. And I don't remember the number, but it's like 100+ companies pitch. And somebody was like counting the number of times that people said AI and the number of pitches that mentioned specific things and stuff. And I think it's like well into the like 60%+ of the batch is AI companies. There's more than 30 companies that have built their own AI models, which is quite expensive usually, and especially for 30 seed stage companies, so I'll be doing it.
Let's talk about that then, because I think that is actually like fascinating, and it seems to be something that, at least to my eyes, already seems to be coming undone. But like building your own model, what's the cost of that? Well, I mean, we're talking about, you know, training a model on a bunch of data, right? You know, in from your eyes, what's like the minimum amount I can spend to kind of get into that game? I know obviously there's like probably cheaper ways to do it, like the Mixtral or whatever, although I don't know how much they're spending. But, you know, from your eyes, how much you got to spend to make a model?
So this is actually a very interesting and hot topic. Mm. Is there is effectively this like bifurcation between you can think of it as like open and closed models or like open and proprietary models. So there are ways to be able to do this more affordably. Like if you're just trying to leverage a model to do something specific, there are a lot of people who have built models, and then you can basically take those and maybe fine tune them a little bit to be able to be specifically like for a specific use case.
Like, right? Open source stuff, are we talking here?
That's right. So like Facebook or Meta has Llama, which is a very popular model. Mistral is a French, very open AI company. There's a bunch of stuff on Hugging Face. Like there's tons of people who have built models specifically trying to be open. And then ironically, leading the pack amongst the not open models is OpenAI. Hmm. They're not open in the sense that like their models are proprietary, right? And so you have to be able to leverage their APIs, and you can certainly you know, leverage their model to do certain things, but you're pretty tied into their ecosystem.
But you got to basically pay them in order to do it.
That's
constantly.
Right. That's right. And so back to your question of like, what does it cost? Like it depends. Like every company can be different. Like they can be leveraging open source. But if you're building a model from scratch, typically it is fairly expensive for a number of reasons. Number one, to your point, like you have to have a lot of data. And for people who are not like large platforms already that already have data, they have to go buy that data. And then you have to be able to like store and compute that data. And so that is just like honestly, just an AWS or Azure charge, right, with Microsoft. But it can be pretty significant depending on the size of the thing that you're trying to accomplish. So there's a lot of just like getting started costs before you even start to actually deploy a model. Mm. And then to be able to deploy a model, you have to think about like how many people are using it, how often, and whatever. And so that also, that scale matters as well. It's like, how big is your use case? And that's one of the things that like at one point at the peak, right? Like it was caught, like, I think when even early days of ChatGPT, when it got into the like, you know, like shot up to a million users super quickly or whatever, it was like costing OpenAI like hundreds of thousands of dollars per day, every day to keep ChatGPT running. Mm. And what is funniest about ChatGPT as like a moment in time is that it was not like a technological breakthrough per se, right? Like GPT as a model had been around for a long time. Large language models, like the process, it's basically based in transformer architecture, which is at this point, like almost a decade old. So none of this stuff was necessarily new, but it was a way of like packaging a very specific tool in a way that most people had not been exposed to. So really it was like an awareness revolution, which is fascinating to me because it wasn't necessarily they built anything magical, but overnight they inherited this like IBM effect almost of like nobody gets fired for using and buying OpenAI because that's the thing that everybody's boomer boss has heard of.
Mm, totally.
Even though it in many cases is probably not the best thing for what you're trying to accomplish, but it's just the easiest thing to convince people you should be paying money for.
Mm. We will get on, this is more to the listener, onto things other than AI, because I know that, you know, there's a fair bit of AI knocking about for one reason or another. But on the data question, what's your take on, you know, that with regards to like copyrighted material, for example, like training video models on YouTube, do you have a position on, you know, what these companies should be doing?
Well, it's funny because I don't know that these companies have positions on what they should be doing.
Totally.
Because when you have like the CTO of OpenAI saying stuff like, I'm not sure if we are training on YouTube, you know, like,
yeah. I don't know if you can say, but I will say that like her equivocation, sorry, for people who didn't see it, the chief technical officer of OpenAI, when asked like, is Sora, your video model, being trained on YouTube? She says, I don't know. She equivocated. I reckon that was possibly for legal reasons rather than...
100%.
Yeah.
I think it's... Yeah, I don't think she's stupid.
Yeah,
I think
total,
she
right?
knows what's going on, right? Yeah. It's legal reasons. But you also... It was funny because I don't remember what the role was, but somebody senior at YouTube talking about if they are using YouTube to train their models, that's obviously in clear violation of our user agreement, our terms of service. You know, we have very clear terms of service that state, and then basically just like faded off and like changed and like, you know, changed the line of talking or whatever.
Yeah.
So I think candidly, like they don't know what they want to happen or they think should happen, or they're like constantly probably trying to like navigate the legal territory of what should and shouldn't be happening. And it's a pretty complicated thing.
Well, it's complicated for Google as well, right? Because they're training, obviously, Gemini on YouTube transcripts as well. But then they have to deal with the second order problem of, like, are you compensating the people who have made these videos for this content? Like, you know, it's still, even on your end, it's sort of a fuzzy partnership. No one knows exactly what they're doing. They're just trying to slurp up as much data as possible.
Yeah. Well, and like the Reddit stuff, right? Like Reddit, which, by the way, like I think could have been a more hypey, momentum driven like process of leveraging the IPO and then talking about AI and having this pitch and stuff like that. I think it was a little bit more like things came out kind of scattershot and stuff.
Yeah.
But Reddit, for those who, I think you guys did, you've done a couple of episodes on talking about the Reddit stuff and things like that. But on their, the thing about AI is that they signed like near sort of maybe a couple of days even before their IPO, Reddit signed this agreement with Google to be able to license their data. And it's like, Google doesn't necessarily need anybody's data. I think there is more this like territorial siphoning off of like, who is the legitimate user of that data, as opposed to like, do you really need it? Can you not get access to it other ways, whatever, right? Google's pretty good at getting access to data.
There's a performative aspect to it for sure. Like, you know, OpenAI does it with like, we're establishing these partnerships with the Associated Press because there are egos that need to be massaged. There's like a sense of legal compliance you need to establish when obviously what the stakes are we just need to be hoovering up whatever we can get.
As well as regulatory capture, right? In that it obviously benefits the Googles and OpenAIs of the world if all of a sudden the new rule is that actually it's all copyrighted material and no one's allowed to train their models on it. But, you know, we've already done it, so oops. Anyway.
Well, it's literally, it's not even like just like boring legal posturing. It's literally like the incitement of existential dread.
Yeah.
That they're leveraging in this legal arena, right? Because there's literally things like there's a talk I've referenced a bunch. It was at a conference in San Francisco maybe a year or two ago called Cerebral Valley. And it was Amjad Massad, who's the CEO of Replit. And he tells this story about with GPT-4, before it had been released, was being teased in Microsoft academic papers and research and things like that. They literally had this like narrative of like, this was the first contact with AGI. And then they like changed it and it like in future versions of it, it said like sparks of AGI, but like it's literally Microsoft is trying to like stoke the flames of like people's fear of like, this is AGI. We're going to have to deal with this. This is going to take jobs. This could be an existential, you know, extinction event, like all this stuff. And it's like, well, who benefits if everybody loses their mind and regulates the crap out of AI? The people who benefit are the largest companies that are spending hundreds of millions of dollars on lobbying efforts. Like, I think that's when you go back to this like closed versus open debate. What is most interesting is watching just these like drooling incentives get bandied back and forth. And it's like, I don't know that I'm scared of anything other than highly incentivized capital driven systems that can lobby for their best interests.
Like, totally.
I think Microsoft's going to do a really good job at that.
I think this is a good transition to talk more generally into VC stuff. I know that your newsletter covered really closely some of the, I guess you could say, poor incentives that dominated the back end of the tech boom, the era of sort of the high burn, high valuation startup where nobody was really working towards creating efficient, long-lasting businesses. They were just raising a stack of money from VC and burning through money. Since you were kind of writing a lot of that stuff, which was now, I guess, you know, 18 months, 2 years ago, one thing that sort of comes to mind is looking at this AI stuff, it feels like some of these incentives sort of bubbling back up again, in the sense that it's like, these are extremely high cost businesses. I always love seeing like tweets of guys that are working on AI startups and they're like, whoa, look at this bill I racked up from OpenAI just because I let my my model run. It's like $18,000 for a day. And obviously this is not representative of like how businesses are behaving. But I think it certainly points to the fact that this is an expensive game and there's a lot of money flying around at the moment. How have things changed or not changed in your view since the markets came down?
Yeah, the unfortunate reality is that I don't think much of anything has changed. And I think that for context, like I often get a lot of confused responses to my blog, newsletter, whatever, because it feels like it's filled with existential self-loathing because I am a VC that loves to crap on how poorly structured the incentives are in venture capital. But I feel like that is like the most way to be intellectually honest is to constantly remind yourself. It's like having a grumpy mother-in-law in my head all the time that's just telling me how terrible I am, right? Like helps me want to prove that voice wrong or whatever. Mm. But like, so like for context, the way that venture capital as an industry has, I think, gotten off track is that it's demonstrated that it's a really valuable way to park a ton of money. And when you have organizations that have like exorbitant, like ungodly, like Saudi oil levels of money, just massive amounts of money, it's like you're not actually looking for the type of yield that you would typically expect from venture capital as like an idea.
Let's talk about that. Yeah, then. So what is the typical venture capital yield? And we spoke about this to Damo a few weeks ago, but like the expectation is like, maybe just go into that very quickly.
Yeah. When you think about like typical early stage venture, when you're investing in a startup, there's a few ways that you can think about like what return am I hoping to generate? One easy standard is like, I hope to generate a 10x return, right? Like I want to make 10x my money. One of the reasons you do that is because of what, you know, the power law, and the really good book by Sebastian Malaby that talks all about how this dynamic works. But basically it's just the idea that like, it's like the 80-20 rule, right? Pareto principle of like the vast majority of my investments will fail. Maybe a few of them will like get me my money back. And so I need the like one or two investments that actually work to do so well that they not only cover all of my losses, but they generate enough return to like have made it worth it for anybody to give me money. Mm. So whether that's 10x, whether that's like the way the contrary thinks about it, we often think about, we want every investment to be capable of being a fund returner. And so we need to say, hey, if we own X amount of this business right now, and we maintain some close to that level of ownership, this company needs to be a X size outcome, because we'll own a certain percentage of it, and that returns our entire fund. Mm. So that's another like rule of thumb. So it's pretty good like that if you can get it, right? Like 10x returns, like those are not easy.
No.
It's not easy to 10x your money on things.
But if you're like a sovereign wealth fund who...
You don't care about that at all.
Well, yeah. You're not... Well, I guess another question to be like, so what size check are you guys writing typically in like a seed round?
So a typical seed round is, call it like $2 to $3 million.
Mm. And so if you're a sovereign wealth fund with like $500 billion to deploy...
A 10X on $2 million is... Yeah, you pay more for paperclips.
Totally. Totally. Yeah. You kind of go into this a bit in your newsletter, distinguishing between, I think you call them like the cottage level funds, which are contrary. And on the other hand, you have your Andreessen Horowitzes, your sort of capital agglomerators, as you call them, where they're playing a totally different game. I guess their LPs don't really expect venture level returns.
And when we say LPs, we're talking about
investors in the fund. Yeah.
Well, could be sovereign wealth funds, right?
It could be. That's right. The way that a fund structure works is there's a ton of people out there that have cash, whether that is a wealthy person that had a business that did well and they're sitting on tens of millions of dollars in their bank account, basically, and they're trying to do stuff with it. They could invest in funds, all the way up to like, I mean, literally like when SoftBank was at its height raising $100 billion funds or whatever, like the Saudi Public Investment Fund was like 40% or something of that SoftBank Vision Fund. Mm. So like they're investing tens of billions of dollars at a time. And so it just depends on like, what is your appetite? Like, what are you trying to do? But for people that are putting out, in many cases, like they're not all the Saudi wealth fund. And so you think about like JP Morgan has a big wealth management business that wants to put out $250-300 million at a time. Like they want to put that into one fund. And for some funds, it's like, that's more than their entire fund times three or four, right? And so when you have these people that have a ton of capital, all they really need to generate like a good enough yield on that size of pool of capital is like a, you know, 1.8 to 2.3x their money over the course of several years, right? Because it doesn't need to be a 20% IRR over the course of 8 to 10 years. It needs to be like an, you know, 8 to 13% or whatever. Mm. So this equation has changed, where it used to be that you had a select group of people who were willing to take venture style risk, investing into funds that were small enough that they wanted to generate 10x returns. And that was like typical venture. That's one of the reasons why folks like Benchmark as a firm have kept their funds relatively small, right? I think they're like, they're trying to raise a consistent size of fund and generate a consistent return profile. Mm. And for some people, that's great. And so that, in my writing, I call those cottage keepers. It's just people that just continue to build this like very similar to, you know, cottage industry, whatever. That's like normal venture. Over the last, call it 10 years, these big pools of capital have recognized that, like, oh, like in venture, the size of the returns can actually be quite good. Like, these are really like, because in some cases you're generating hundreds and hundreds of X, right? Returns, like 300-400 times your money. And so these massive outcomes, it's like, well, man, being exposed to this at all is good. One of the tricky parts was they said, well, I want to put $300 million to work. And I don't want to put $50 million or $20 million to work. And so firms like Andreessen came along and said, you know what? We could take that money. And so they raised, you know, I think they just announced a new set of funds, and it's like $6 billion or $9 billion of funds. That means they're going to deploy like whatever it is, $6 or $9 billion over the next 2 or 3 years. Like, that's a huge amount of money. And so you're just not going to find these returns that are going to generate 10x returns at that price.
Because they're still looking for these kind of, well, quote unquote, smaller, high growth potential businesses here. Like, right, we're not talking about investing in like infrastructure or, you know, big plays like that. And so that's distorting the market is the idea.
The argument is that there are only so many companies, like there's only so many top 1% companies out there that you can invest in that are going to generate these massive outcomes. But the thing that has kind of enabled that even more, which is why I think things have not changed, is like you have three groups of people who are like a match made in heaven, capital inferno heaven, or maybe capital inferno hell. But like you have people that have massive amounts of money, right? Like the Saudis. And then you have funds like the Andreessen Horowitz of the world who are willing to raise billions and billions and billions of dollars, just mass agglomerate capital.
And for the record, we should probably point out that they're getting, you know, 2 and 20 on this. So they're getting kind of 2% annually of the size of the fund and then 20% of all returns. So it's in their interest to make these funds as big as possible and deploy them as fast as possible.
Well, and like one of the most fascinating analogies, so I wrote this other piece called The Blackstone of Innovation. And for those of you who don't know Blackstone is one of the largest asset managers in the world, like Blackstone and BlackRock. And even BlackRock was like an offshoot from Blackstone. So two of the largest asset managers in the world that are managing $1 trillion plus of assets. So Blackstone had this strategy. Steve Schwarzman is the guy that started it. He has this great quote where he basically says, we were different than everybody else, because everybody else would say, oh, we're in the private credit business or we're in the real estate business. And he said, I'm in the asset management business. So I don't care what it is. Like, if I can find a person that has a strategy, I'm going to do that thing. And so that's how you get to be $1 trillion of assets, is because you will literally do anything. And in venture, it had always been this like very specific type of investing, and you invested in a specific type of companies. You're typically looking for like capital efficient businesses. That's why people love software. And for a long time, even though venture capital was born out of the semiconductor manufacturing of the 1950s in Silicon Valley, it's gotten away for the most part from hardware and stuff like that, because you're typically looking for like capital efficient business. But that's all changed as you've gotten away. You've kind of evolved this model. And so firms like Andreessen, they are these sort of like Blackstone-esque businesses where they're saying, we will invest in all kinds of different types of businesses. They're still like largely in tech, but things like defense and aerospace and new age manufacturing and stuff like that, robotics, like a lot of those things are coming back into vogue. And like in part, there's a ton of valid like macroeconomic drivers behind that, right? Like global conflict is coming back, and like there's all these reasons, like manufacturing is more at risk in a rapidly deglobalizing world. And so it's not that those themes are stupid and made up, they are legitimate. But you have people who are agglomerating capital and they're saying, where can I put it? And they're looking for places that like, oh, actually they can take a ton of capital. Because if I, as Andreessen, can go park, you know, $150 million a pop, it's the same reason why the Saudis love Andreessen, because they can put $300 million dollars a pop. Andreessen loves capital intensive businesses because they can put more money to work.
So the third person in the menage a trois... What is the businesses? Is that right?
That's right. The capital intensive businesses. That's right.
Yeah.
And so like these, so for example, like the OpenAIs of the world, who not only want billions of dollars to be able to go do this stuff, but potentially raise $1 trillion or have hundreds of billions of dollars to go build chip factories. And so, and it's like that, like for the capital agglomerator, that level of capital intensity makes them drool.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons why the like size of the amount of capital you're managing is so important is you go back to the Blackstone example. Blackstone is a publicly traded company. When most people value Blackstone as a company, they don't care at all about the 20%, right? So you mentioned the 2 and the 20. Mm. Basically, I as a capital allocator, my business model is I have capital that I manage and I get an annual income stream of 2% of the capital I'm managing every year to keep the lights on, pay the bills, pay my people, whatever. Plus, I get 20% of the upside of whatever I make. So first I have to, like if I raise a $1 billion fund and I make $10 billion, I first have to take the billion and give it back. And then of the $9 billion increase, I get 20% of that. And it's pretty good. But Blackstone is a publicly traded company. Analysts completely write off the upside. Like they don't care. All they care about is that Blackstone is a trusted enough asset that it can continue to collect on that 2% like a freaking treasury bond, like just an annuity. Like that is all that Blackstone stock is valued on, is the annuity of that fee stream.
Recurring revenue.
That's right. And you think this is playing out with big VC like Andreessen as well? Like at the end of the day, it becomes about the recurring fee?
They would never say that. I think that is an unavoidable incentive, right? Like if the more assets you have under management drives more fees and more things.
Yep.
Andreessen is certainly like doing it the best.
Yeah.
But a lot of firms have gotten much, much bigger than ever before.
Totally.
And I think that most of these firms, they're doing totally fine. Like they're making a ton of money anyway. They're most of the best firms in the world anyway. So they've made a ton of money. So I don't know that it's like, we just want more fees in our pocket.
Yeah.
But I think it is largely like an ambition game. Where like I, as Andreessen, if I have, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars of like operating budget, I can go hire like hundreds of people. Like I think Andreessen has, I don't remember the exact number, but it's like, I mean, they certainly have like hundreds of employees.
Yeah.
And I think like they're now past 100 like investing partners, which is insane when you look at like Benchmark has five or six. Right? Like just like the scale is totally different.
Getting back to the point of like they want safe places to basically park these vast amounts of money. You use this as an explanation as to, because you know there was the big blow up when all of a sudden they put, how much was it? Like was it $300
million? $300 million.
Into Adam Neumann's business. And everyone was like, this guy's a fraud. He's a moron. He's an idiot. And
I wouldn't call him a fraud. I call him a visionary.
Okay, well, me too. But don't put words in my mouth. I'm talking about the frauds in the media called him. But like this was, you explain it by this way, where it's like this is a guy who has a demonstrated track record in like being able to have and deploy huge amounts of money and spend it on his business and blah, blah, blah. He's in like a really, really capital intensive business, which is real estate. I believe you put it that this is kind of the thinking of Andreessen, right? Like this is somebody we can give a huge amount of money to and he'll, you know, put it to work.
So this is like, and I keep coming back because it's called The Puritans of Venture Capital is the piece that I wrote that kind of compares these like cottage keepers and capital agglomerators and stuff. And then there's another piece I wrote called The Rise of the Cash Man, which is where I talked about this Adam Neumann thing. But in all of these pieces where I sort of like try and unveil like, hey, like these are probably the incentives at work. I try and illustrate effectively that I am a believer in, for the most part, in the idea of like, don't hate the player, hate the game.
Sure. Mm.
Like, I don't think the people at Andreessen are bad people. I don't think that Adam Neumann is a bad guy. I don't think that, you know, the Saudis, maybe that's a different discussion. But like, for the most part, sure. like I don't know that these people are bad. I think that they are a product of their incentives.
Yeah,
incentives are really tricky, right? But in this specific example, because even like the OpenAI stuff, and it's interesting, and the defense stuff, and it's interesting. But like, man, there's not a better holy trinity of like capital something. I don't know, destruction, allocation, whatever you want to call it.
Yep.
But like Saudi wealth money goes into Andreessen Horowitz. Andreessen puts $300 million or so into Adam Neumann's new business. And like, for those who don't know, effectively what the business is called Flow. And as far as anybody can tell, because there's not too much information on it, but as far as anybody can tell, basically Adam Neumann, I mean, he made off like a bandit.
This is the WeWork guy. Have we mentioned WeWork yet?
Yeah, he's talking. Well, I don't know if we have in this episode.
No, I mean, in this episode. We've mentioned a million times in the pod, but yeah. The WeWork guy.
Yeah.
The WeWork guy, yeah. Well, and basically he went from commercial real estate, made $1 billion failing at commercial real estate, and sort of segued that into residential real estate. And so he started buying a bunch of luxury apartment complexes in places like Nashville, Tennessee, and all, not, you know, not the like New York and San Francisco and LA, but like these sort of like, there's still like bougier areas in different cities around the US and stuff like that. So he bought a bunch of this like residential real estate. And the idea was that Flow is this like, it's basically just take the WeWork vision, but apply it. And he even in WeWork, they had WeLive, which was like co-living and stuff like that. So this is like similar to that. Andreessen Horowitz, when they wrote their blog post about why they invested in Flow, which by the way, it is the largest single investment Andreessen Horowitz has ever made. That $300 million at one pop, right? They've maybe put more into companies over the course of years.
Yeah.
But at one time, this is the largest investment they've ever made. And in it, Mark Andreessen talks about this piece that he wrote about it's time to build. And they talked about like it's time to build housing. And like there's a housing crisis in the United States, right? Then fast forward, as people kind of dig into like, well, what is Flow? What kind of properties do they own? These are like, this is not solving the housing crisis. Like these are like the luxurious of the luxury housing. Like they have like saltwater pools and dog valets. And like these are like very nice spots.
That's normal in Australia. Every house has that.
So we're catching up. Yeah, that's right. The US is catching up to Australia's standards of living. These are like pristine, you know, properties. But it's like, man, like Saudi wealth money into a fund that has proven they can deploy a ton of money into a guy who has proven that he can raise a shiz ton of money. I think he raised like $12 or $13 billion for WeWork over the course of several years. And there was literally, I don't ever remember the details, but there was a conference that was sponsored. And it wasn't like a, oh, this is secretly sponsored by, it was like very matter of factly sponsored by the Saudi crown. And on stage at this conference, you had Mark Andreessen and Ben Horowitz, the founders of Andreessen and Horowitz, and Adam Neumann on stage talking about how MBS is the type of leader that the world needs more of. And it's like, that feels super weird. Like, I don't know that that's a hot take. I don't know if I agree with that. And it's like, and it's just so like quiet part out loud that it's like people with capital giving it to people who can deploy capital into companies that have proven they're going to be capital intensive. And he wants to do this thing and buy real estate and do all this stuff. And
the weird
it doesn't
thing...
feel good, but it, but it like, it perfectly like it, again, that's just a perfect illustration of the incentives.
The incentives, yeah.
But the other thing about it that kind of weirds me out a little bit, and this is like far removed from then the weird ethics and whatnot, though, is like that kind of just sounds like a private equity play here when you're buying up residential real estate, and presumably, I know he's got like plans or whatever for everyone in these buildings to use.
A crypto wallet or whatever.
Exactly, well, whatever. But realistically, what he's presumably talking about here is like, renting it out for recurring revenue, right? Like, it, which is like, this is just like, it's kind of come back onto like, it's called VC because it's got a crazy founder, but it's like, that just sounds like private equity to me, right? Like, I mean, I know that the idea
here
is.
With some extra steps. The app elevates.
Yeah.
I'm a firm believer that like storytelling is very powerful, but at the end of the day, reality is what matters and it will catch up. And I've increasingly become convinced that like storytelling shapes reality. Like, it doesn't matter what is real. It matters what people believe. And largely, those beliefs create reality. And so to your point, like, on paper, like, yes, it is effectively just a real estate roll-up. Like, it's not that different.
But even from the investment all the way through to a certain extent. But, yeah.
Yeah. The difference is the story that you tell and how long you can keep people believing it. Or you kind of like have to bridge that belief until either it becomes true or you make $1 billion and your commercial real estate company crumbles into bankruptcy. Like one of those two things will happen. Either like he was going to build WeWork into $100 billion behemoth that like controls the way every single person works in an office, or he was going to get out with $1 billion and it was going to crumble into bankruptcy. Like one of those two things is going to happen when you're a really effective storyteller.
So, I mean, you've essentially talked about the fact that the incentives haven't really changed, even though, you know, there was this period of like chastening where everyone was like, all right, things got a little bit out of hand during the surge. You know, there were a lot of unsustainable businesses that got a lot of money. They didn't really build proper businesses, essentially, that were actually going to stand the test of time. They had $1 billion plus valuations. I think you made the point at some point where it was like, you know, it doesn't make sense that there are 1,000 plus unicorns when there are only like $400 billion plus companies on the public markets anyway. has there been any changes in the way that like companies are run and like startups are being run outside of the, I guess you could say, surface level froth of, oh, we're all running the Elon playbook now. You know, we're all hardcore operators. We don't have too many people. There are no table tennis tables in our office anymore. We're, you know, we're in on it. We're working. Like, is there, has it actually changed the way that founders think about their businesses, and also additionally the way VCs are sort of encouraging founders to run their businesses?
Basically, I think what has happened is you can picture like any chart you've ever seen that articulate the sort of like broadening wealth gap of like income inequality over time. You can apply that chart to what's happening among both like VCs and startups, just like the whole ecosystem. It's like it used to be that like most venture funds had some similarities. They maybe saw similar things. They maybe paid similar prices. And same thing on the company side. Like most companies had, even though no company had a super high likelihood of surviving, they all had a similar likelihood. And so it was all kind of very in the same place, right? And then over the last couple of years, you've had this like increasing sort of inequality of outcomes. And I think that like, has anything changed? I think maybe it shook up like who was in which bucket, because there are some people that I think have like had gotten hit kind of hard, and they may not feel very high income right now, right? Like I think that some of the crypto firms, even as crypto comes back, I think that many of them took like big hits and had a lot of egg on their face, and like that's hard to come back from and stuff. So I think that they maybe don't feel as privileged as other top 1% venture funds. And on the same token, on the company side, like there were a lot of companies that were like, they were the hottest thing on the planet. And now like very few people will talk to them, right?
What kind of like verticals are we talking?
Either companies that hit like very specific cyclical trends, right? Like there's a lot of companies that like spiked in during travel limitations and stuff during COVID, remote work company. Right? Basically picture like the Zoom and Peloton stock charts tanking. Those companies have not come back. The companies that were like, that was never going to, you know, Hopin is another example. For those who don't know, Hopin is basically like a virtual events platform. So it's for like people who couldn't do big conferences in person. There was this platform that would allow you to like put together booths that people could come visit all virtually and whatever. Mm-hmm. And Hopin is a perfect example of like that company's not coming back because it has now effectively failed. So there are certainly those companies that hit like just cyclical headwinds that like it's tough to come back from. Or there are companies that
Do you mind if we pause for a second on that though? So Hopin, like a company like that, so they're doing virtual events, COVID hits, all of a sudden there's just like a million VCs are opening their checkbooks and wanting to write them checks. Then all of a sudden, obviously the growth slows down or it can't keep up at that rapid pace. And they're basically too big for the amount of money that they're spending. But what should a company do in that situation? Like, I almost feel like the outcome is predetermined. Like if you're a business and all of a sudden you can raise at these high valuations, like how does a business like that, they just have to say no to certain valuations?
This is the reason why most people blame VCs for the excess, because we are at the end of the day, the like catalyst that triggers what feels like kind of irresponsible behavior. But that's what it's like, this idea of the greater fool, right? People talk a lot about like passing the bag, and it's like, and then who's going to be a bag holder? Like who gets left at the end holding this like giant pile of crap? But like Hopin is a company that like, to your point, like it's not that it like, oh, that's unfortunate. Like they had some stuff that changed surprisingly or whatever. It's like, that's a business that should have never been what it was ever.
Yeah.
Like that company went again, like this is, I mean, think about like heat of COVID, everything's locked down. People have big conferences that represent big revenue opportunities. It's like, that sucks. You can't do that conference. Here's this platform that you can. They went from something, I'm going to make up the numbers, but just to give you a sense of like the scale, it was like they went from something like maybe a couple hundred events per month to like tens of thousands, like high tens of thousands of events per month. They went from maybe 3 or 4 million of revenue to like 75 million of revenue to like 200 or 300 million of revenue over the course of like a year or two, right? And so they ended up raising at a $7 billion valuation. And it's like, there's these quotes that are just like baffling to me of people being like, you know, like, man, virtual events just went away way faster than we expected. And it's like, who thought that was going to stay the way we're going to do stuff forever?
Like, who attended one of them and was like, oh, this rocks.
This is the future. Like most people go to conferences to get drunk and like not think about their work. who wants to be sitting at home just being like, this is a bummer, you know? Like, of course that was not going to stay the same once things got back to normal. But people just, like, convince them. Again, it goes back to the storytelling. Like, you tell this big enough story that it's like, this is going to be the professional metaverse. And you're like, wow, like, that's crazy. And, like, look at their revenue. Like, if this continues on, even if they slow down a little bit, this is going to be an incredible business.
I hope the founders took some money off the table there.
He took $200 million off the table.
Oh, wait, was he the Australian guy? Is this a UK founder?
He's UK. He's a UK founder.
I think he might originally have been another one of... We're good at sending scams over there. Fast, you know. Sorry, allegedly, allegedly.
You send the criminals here 200 years ago. And then
this is payback.
Then you build, then 200 years later, a huge number of scams just explode out. You know, you get Fast or what? Was it Fast?
Yeah, Fast.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, yeah. Another beautiful Australian scam.
Beautiful.
But speaking of Australian companies, this is actually a question that I wanted to ask. In the headlines recently was that Canva did a big secondary sale, so, you know, to make whole out of their early employees and investors and so on. And and you've been hearing about this a lot, especially as, like, the time to IPO sort of stretches out. Reddit was sort of like the first glimmer of a tech IPO that we've had in a little while. VCs thinking a bit differently about, like, exits. And for the benefit of the listeners, we've said this time and time again, but normally the two classic ways you exit are you're acquired or you go public. But another way you can do it is to sell stock on the secondary market.
Yeah, yeah. There's people who've been working at Canva for 10 years or whatever. And
getting a bit antsy, understandably. Exactly. Is it making you guys and other VCs think differently about exit timelines and opportunities?
100%. It changes the math. This is another one of the, like, tricky incentives thing.
Yeah, totally.
Is, like, I have this line that I'm very proud of that I wrote, where VCs talk about themselves as being long-term investors.
Yeah.
Whereas we invest for 10 plus years, right? That's the life of our fund. But the reality is that venture capital firms are just collections of short-term careerists who are trying to associate themselves with as much success as possible, as quickly as possible, and distance themselves from as much failure as possible for as long as possible, right?
Couldn't be me.
I would never do that.
And so, like, the problem is that, like, when, and this is the justification that people made during COVID and during the run-up and stuff, is, like, you look at, like, Zoom and you say, well, man, if Zoom is a, whatever it was, $100 billion company or whatever, if Hopin can be even 10%, it can be a $10 billion company. And so why wouldn't we invest at $3 or $5 or $7 billion? Because in short order, it could become a $10 billion company and maybe even more because Zoom is the upside. And then Zoom tanks into a fraction of that. And you're like, oh crap, like the whole math falls apart. Like there was actually no math to begin with, right? And so people use IPOs as a, like, you know, pulse on, like, how good of an idea is this investment? Because if I look at that thing, how much can it, you know? But, like, the public markets are now littered with companies where you're like, you know, like, I remember Blue Apron, the food delivery meal kit. That I remember, I mean, years ago, this was like an isolated incident where it was like Blue Apron went public and, like, traded down so hard that it had, like, a $20 million market cap. Like, it had raised it, like, I don't remember, like, several billion dollars valuation, and then had gone down to like $20 million. And it was like a legitimate penny stock. Like it was just, it was bonkers, right?
Yeah.
And people looked at that and they said, well, that's just like an isolated incident. And now there are like dozens of public companies that went public during the SPAC boom and all this stuff and whatever that are in the like $300-400 million range. And it's like, but people continue to ignore those. Like they're like, oh, that sucks. But we'll grow faster than that. Like we'll be better company than that. That won't happen to us, you know? And it's like it seems like people are largely incapable of learning the lessons of cautionary tales.
Well, but is part of that just because there's so much money flowing around that needs to be deployed still, right? It's almost like if money has to go somewhere, and so valuations have to stay high, and so the optimism has to stay high, so companies are always going to get highly valued. What my brain goes to is you're kind of talking, you were talking about earlier, when there is all of these big like investments and big funds, it pushes up the valuation, which must make your job a lot harder. So if people are only looking for 10x returns or, you know, they're 20% a year-on-year returns or less, 15%, whatever, they just basically want to beat the S&P 500, what does that mean for you guys who are still doing the more kind of traditional venture capital?
Well, it goes back to this idea of like the inequality because it's not that every company will be super highly valued. Like, it's not a universal thing. It is increasingly a more centralized thing. And so the same VCs will chase the same small subset of deals of companies, and those companies will see incredible explosions in valuation and stuff like that, right?
Yeah, you're kind of like very much focused on the founder, which, you know, I understand a lot of VCs, that's kind of the angle. But that, am I making the right assumption that like that kind of 1% or whatever you want to call it, that kind of channel of the ones who are always going to get funding because everyone's interested in them, probably similar type of founder from the similar schools who are getting recognized quite early as talent? Or is that maybe the wrong assumption?
Yes and no. Like, it, broad strokes, that is true. Like, there is a crazy pattern recognition concentration problem in VC where people look for people who look and sound the same with similar backgrounds and come from similar places, whether it's the schools they come from or the companies they've worked at or whatever. That's definitely like a broadly a problem. The within that, like, select universe of people who have gone to certain number of schools or have had certain experiences or whatever, there are still, you know, hundreds of thousands, probably millions of people that fit that profile, right? If you count all the people that have ever worked at Uber, all the people that have ever worked at Canva and Stripe and Airbnb and whatever, it's like there's still a ton of people in that pool. And so the question becomes, how do you identify those people? And for contrary, one of the ways that we approach it differently is we'll talk all the time about we want to identify people just like one clip earlier before anybody else. And the way that we do that, so I have been at venture firms in the past, right? I've been investing for 10 years. I've been at Contrary for about a year and a half. So prior to this, I was at Index Ventures and Coatue, like all firms in the US. And while I was there, I joke that I would frequently play the hurry up and wait game where, like, if I found somebody that I thought was super sharp, I kind of just was like waiting for them to start a company. Because until they start a company, I don't have a product for them, right? Like, I can give you capital, I can do whatever, but until you start a company, you put your hand up, all I can do is I can maybe invite you to a dinner every once in a while. And it's like, that's it. We can just get to know each other. Contrary spends, in many cases, years, like 5-6+ years, doing things for the people like that we are close to, helping them throughout their career. So, like, often we'll meet people in undergrad, grad school, PhD programs, whatever. We're helping them get their first job. We're helping them join a startup. We're helping them network with people, find mentors. Like, there's a bunch of different product SKUs that Contrary has to make us relevant in that person's life long before they ever start a company, in the hopes that when they do start thinking about a company, we're their first call because we've been spending years like engaging with them and building that relationship. The problem with that is that it's a crazy long-term game. And it's, you have this like risk of backing the wrong horse, right? Like, if we spend 5 years getting to know somebody and they say, you know, I just want to go work at Google and make good money for a long time. It's like, oh, bummer. Like, that was, you know, and so like, we have to build in all of these systems, even if not every single person that comes through it ends up being like that top 1% founder.
Yeah. What's to stop other VCs doing that?
It just takes a really long time and it is not a normal part of the business.
Yeah.
Like, again, going back to this idea of like people, the venture firms are collections of careerists who are just have a very specific mindset.
They want to be able to say that I was an early investor in Uber and then move on and, you know.
Yeah. Like, I'm hunting that next deal, that next hot thing when it gets hot.
Yeah.
And the problem, and that is largely what causes the problem, where once something, like, there is this, so Peter Thiel has this quote about how any competitive round in a startup, like when you're investing in a startup, if it was competitive, by definition, that valuation is undervalued. Because if you think about it as like a pure economic calculation of supply and demand, if you said, okay, Stripe at $50 billion, could you go out as Stripe and find somebody who is willing to invest at $60 billion? And it's like, yes. It's like, okay, where does the supply and demand hit equilibrium where like there's no longer any more demand at a higher price? And it's almost never, like, if you ask anybody, like, OpenAI, $100 billion, would you do it? And it's like, there are for sure people who, if given the opportunity, would do it at more than $100 billion. And so by definition, $100 billion is undervalued because you've not reached maximum equilibrium of supply and demand. And so that creates this, like, FOMO fervor of everybody and their mother tripping over themselves to give a higher price to the select group of things that appear to be hot.
Yeah, I feel like AI, I think, has a unique sort of flavor in this dimension where it's kind of like, You know, and I've heard people make the argument where it's like the OpenAI strategy is we are going to like bum rush towards AGI and like not worry about all the little extraneous things about how we're making money from our, you know, our API store, which obviously doesn't seem to have worked all that well, because whoever gets to AGI, however you want to define that, is the winner and we've won. So for like an investor, what is the ceiling on something where you're being told over and over again, the moment this sucker hits, the world is going to be so unbelievably different and the economy is not going to work the same anymore and human labor is going to be vastly disrupted. So who cares if we like get in at $1 trillion?
Yeah, well, and that Altman's particularly good at this, right?
He's very good at
saying like, oh yeah, I want to raise $7 trillion. And like, you know, the other day he was saying, the iPhone total addressable market was nothing in compared to AI. It's just like, I have a higher TAM than Apple.
Yeah, totally.
It's like, he's good at kind of juicing it.
Yeah,
totally. You know, and again, like I hesitate to draw comparisons between FTX and OpenAI. But that is word for word how SBF talked about FTX, where he said every transaction that occurs in the global economy should be addressable by FTX. So our global TAM is the global economy.
Yeah.
And it's like, wow, like give this guy $1 billion. Like I'm tripping out of my seat to give this dude money.
Yeah.
And it's like, I think that Sam Altman is a dramatically better founder, more intelligent person than SBF. Like OpenAI as a business, dramatically better than FTX as a business. Like, so I hesitate to even draw the comparison, but it goes back to this idea of storytelling.
Yeah.
And like Sam Altman is an incredible storyteller and he paints this picture and either he is right and they get to AGI and $100 billion is like chump change compared to the global revolution that they lead the charge on.
Yeah.
Or the people involved get money out and it kind of whatever, right? But like the story is going to go somewhere. Mm. The question is it's two things. Number one, do you buy into that story for that company? But then number two is how much energy have you exerted to tell that story? And that energy creates this like tidal wave. And how many people can coast to the tidal wave saying, yeah, and also us. Like he's going to be a $1 trillion company, but we're going to be a $100 billion company. $2 billion for our seed round is nothing because it's coasting on this.
We're being dragged along by this. Yeah, our AI girlfriend app, you know.
Yeah.
We're not, our TAM isn't the whole world, but it's half of it.
Half of it, yeah.
Where do you think... Give us the next 5 years for AI. I know that's a very tough question, but I'm putting you on the spot. Right now, the hottest kind of topic is like, it's a bubble. There's no real uses for the generative AI stuff because they get things wrong versus the whole world is going to be revolutionized and like 80% of people are losing their job. Yeah, are you A or are you B? Those are your two options.
Well, I'll tell you a story first because it's late my time, so I get to decide when I hang up.
Oh, sure.
So I actually interviewed the CEO of a company called Cohere for Contrary Research, which James and I worked on together. And I asked him the same question. I actually asked him, what do you think happens over the next 10 years? And he said, the next 10 years are indiscernible. Like it is impossible to know what's going to happen over the next 10 years. Maybe I'll give you the next 5 years and even then I'll probably be wrong. But I asked him the question and he focused really specifically on what is going to happen in like AI infrastructure, which is what he's focused on. So he's an OpenAI competitor. And he talked about how things like, for example, like transformer architecture is what has unlocked this large language model revolution. And his main kind of hot take or takeaway was that if in 5 years we are still leaning heavily on transformer architecture, he would be very surprised and disappointed.
Yeah.
And so if you think about like, okay, like here is this architectural change that unlocked this massive wave. If we keep making those unlocks, it's pretty powerful, but it also like it creates orders of magnitude of difficulty to forecast what happens because you don't know what that's going to look like.
Because I guess the alternative to that is we don't get that next unlock, and then that does put a ceiling on kind of where we're at least in the generative AI space with, you know, ChatGPT 5, 6, 7 can only be so much better than it currently is now.
That's his argument, right?
But if we do...
Yeah, it could be huge, right? And to your question of like, so is it a bubble and is it nothing? Or is it this like massive unlock that's going to completely revolutionize the global economy? Like, again, I think it is a story of inequality where there are certain companies that will create certain things that will have massive implications. Not every company will benefit from that as much as they will try and they will coast, right? You've already seen this. There was a, it's a longer story to go into the weavings, but I've seen stuff on Twitter, people talking about like all these takeaways in AI. And one of the things that a lot of people are talking about right now is there have been two high profile, not necessarily like failures per se, but like two high profile hiccups in AI. Mm. One is a company called Inflection and one is a company called Stability.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Inflection is the one that Microsoft invested, I think, $1 billion into. And then basically the co-founder of the company was the former co-founder of DeepMind. And Microsoft basically said, hey, you should come run this Microsoft AI research lab. And he was like sick. And so he bounced as like the founder of Inflection. He just left it and went. And like, there's a bunch of this stuff of like, well, they're going to keep doing things, but they're going to change their vision.
Yeah,
really, it was like Microsoft just hollowed out the talent of the company.
Yeah.
Because a bunch of people got Microsoft AI offers from Inflection. So like, it wasn't just him. Mm. It was several, like they basically took a bunch of the talent from the company and left it this like
a shell.
Hollow shell.
A hollow shell that allegedly will repay at least investors.
That's what Reid Hoffman said.
Yeah. But so my take on that one was like, to me, that looks like a Microsoft attempted acquihire, because it sounds like Inflection spent way too much on compute. But because of basically competition regulation and the state of the FTC, they can't actually buy anything right now. And so they're kind of working out these convoluted structures, much like they did with OpenAI, to effectively perform an acquihire for...
Yeah. Well, and a lot of people have started talking about, there's whispers that the FTC is going to start investigating not even the acquisitions, but even just these equity investments into AI startups and their anti-competitive nature.
Yep.
Because it is, it's to be fair, right? Like a lot of people talk about, it's like, oh, like how much did Microsoft invest in OpenAI or Amazon in Anthropic, right? Mm. And it's like, we don't know the details of how much of that is like compute.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And you're basically giving like a large chunk of that is Microsoft basically just saying like, hey, we'll give you access to compute.
Yeah, you can get startup credits. You can get Azure startup credits.
It literally, it's like that times like multiple billions, yeah. Right? So Inflection getting hollowed out is an example. Mm. And Stability was never like, a lot of people, I think, kind of saw the writing on the wall with that company because they had a lot of like sus claims about how much, ownership they had over Stable Diffusion as this like core model. And there's actually a company called Runway, which is like a video research, AI research lab that like they were largely responsible for a lot of, and a few other folks, but it mostly wasn't actually Stability. They were just using it.
Yeah, and Emad, so that company has been quirky guy as well, by all accounts.
Yeah. So that company's been suspect for a long time. But like him leaving is like the final, like, you know, sweeping the legs out from that story, right? So that story goes away. So I think that there are going to be way more of those. Like there's a ton of companies that like are not going to live up to the hype. They're going to burn a shiz ton of money. And they're not going to deliver anything that, I mean, even you look at things like Perplexity, which has gotten a lot of hype because it's grown so fast, people really like it. And some people have called it like the first legitimate threat to Google's dominance and stuff in search. And it's like, I've used Perplexity. It's great. Like, it's a really great tool.
Yeah.
Their website, they literally like, they took a position as search deserves to be free of the ads based model. And that went away sometime in the last month.
Yeah.
And around that same time window, they announced their intentions to start selling ads. Like they're going to have to say either, this didn't work, or we have to like create some business case for why people should pay us money.
You can be building a computer god in a Microsoft Azure server, but you cannot liberate yourself from the fact that you must at some point become an advertising business.
Right.
You must be an ad business, or you know,
death, taxes, and ad.
Ads, or a bank, or whatever.
But like with that, Kyle. So I kind of feel like businesses got away with basically not having a proper business model previously for a lot longer. In that, 5 years ago, 4 years ago, 3 years ago, you could have shocking revenue, but hand wave it away because of like what the future will hold. And I kind of feel like in this AI cycle, it's happening a lot quicker. It's like you have all this potential before you actually have customers. Then you go to market and kind of 9 months later, if the revenue is not there, then the companies feel like there's more scrutiny perhaps. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's kind of my vibe right now. People are actually looking at the P&Ls slightly closer maybe than they previously did. I don't know. Maybe that's wrong. I'm a long way away.
Yeah, I think that's wrong.
Okay.
There is just as little scrutiny in most cases.
Mm.
The few cases we've seen of failure, I think, have unique outliers.
Mm.
And one of the things that I think does like stir up the dust more than in like the crypto 2021 craziness is the like intrusion of these big tech companies, right?
Yep.
Number one, because they're participants, right? Where you have like Google with Gemini or Facebook with Llama or whatever. It's like they're getting into it. But number two, they're like massively incentivized from a capital perspective to own this world, right? Because it's basically an extension of the cloud wars, right? Because it's so dependent on compute. So I think that that, so like Infleqtion being an example is like, if this was normal and they were just like living on hype, they could have lived a lot longer on hype. But Microsoft was like, F it, I'm done with this nonsense. I want to build Microsoft AI. And I have a billion reasons why you should come do it over here.
Right? Yeah, true. And so allegedly, like, they actually did have a bunch of GPUs. I know there's some weirdness around they're actually, you know, not they're stored in the server and whatever. But like even that, I guess, is short in supply. So there's benefit. Microsoft's just like, rather than us invest in you, how about we just have access to that compute because we can sell it or we know we can.
So I think that like that creates some unique situations. Or there's like just like kind of uniquely dumb situations like the stability stuff. Where like that, because there was stuff in crypto that failed even before the tide went out, right?
Yeah, that's true.
And I think that was just like uniquely dumb stuff.
I mean, WeWork failed before before the crash.
That's true.
Yeah, seriously. Well, like the vast majority of AI hype is still in full force. Mm. Like it's still very healthy and very, and I think a lot of it, like the same way that like in 2022, when stuff changed and people weren't investing and stuff, people would say like, I think there is a tidal wave of companies going out of business. And it's like that has proven true. Like into 2023 and into 2024, you've seen lots more companies shut down or lots more like small acquisitions and acquihires and stuff, where it's basically just people fail to find product market fit and they get consolidated. Like that mass extinction event for startups that people called when the economy changed, I think that will happen in AI. But it's like it's hard because you kind of have to take to back to your original question of like, is it this generational economic revolution or is it this hype cycle? I think it is both. Like for a lot of companies, it's just people riding the hype. But I am absolutely convinced that there will be a subset of company that dramatically change the way when you think about music, art, like content, like everything across the board that these things touch. I think it's going to be massively powerful and people are going to figure out how to use this stuff in production and it's going to be really valuable, but it is not going to be the vast majority of companies.
Yeah. It's a sensible middle ground. Yeah. We said A or B and you chose C, but that's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you for obviously being lead investor in the Down Round, like a podcast AI distribution and creation company. It
doesn't very, have generous check. Very generous check. Very generous check. That's crazy.
Imagine personalized Down Round 5 times a day to every individual on the planet.
Wow. Unbelievable. It's going to the moon, folks. Carl, thank you so much for joining us. Obviously, I'm going to drop a link to your newsletter in the show notes. I recommend everyone read it. It's very good.
This is great. I've enjoyed this a ton. It's super fun to get to chat with you guys.
If you're listening to this, did you know there's another world out there where you get a second episode of Down Round a week?
Yep, it's called Down Round Premium.
That's right. And there's no interruptions.
No interruptions, no ads, 2 episodes a week, including the free one you're getting right now, plus another one.
Yep, $7 a month, not a week, a month, downround.net. Downround.net, instant access to the whole back catalog as well. You've got so much to catch up on.
There's so much. Get around it.